Hello and welcome to Trails Worth Hiking, the show that brings you some of the most interesting backpacking and trekking routes in the world. I'm your host, Jeremy Pendry. In the first part of the show, we bring you the story and history of a trail. Then we tell you what it's like to hike the trail and how you can do it. On this episode, we describe a trail that brings you close up to a volcanic mountain landscape dotted with ancient lava flows, serene lakes, beautiful cascades, and deep forests where, if you're lucky, you might be able to catch a glimpse of Bigfoot. The trail traverses an almost 50-mile or 80-kilometer loop that traces an oval around three imposing stratovolcanoes, each of which rises more than 10,000 feet or 3,000 meters above sea level. The volcanoes are called the Three Sisters. One of them may only be sleeping and could wake again someday. This episode on Trails Worth Hiking, we travel the Three Sisters Loop in the Cascade Mountains in Central Oregon. Thank you for joining me to listen to the show. Today, we have as a guest Katie Cook. Katie has a website called Trees and Tents, treesandtents.com, that is focused on getting women out backpacking. Katie has a lot of great information on her site, including a free guide to help women learn the basics of backpacking and get out backpacking. And she also has some really good route descriptions of different trails she has hiked, including the trail that we're going to be talking about today, the Three Sisters Loop. I want to talk for a moment about why I was interested to cover this trail on the show. Who we hike with shapes the experience, and it's really important. It shapes the trip, but more importantly, it shapes how I remember a trip. And one of the things that's really important about who we hike with is the enormous amount of time you spend with the person on the trail. As adults, we rarely get a lot of time to spend with other adults the way we did when we were kids. When you're a kid, you might spend weeks playing outside in the summer with the same two or three friends. And by the end of summer, you know each other as well as two people can almost know each other. But as adults, it's really hard to get that experience. It's really hard to spend significant leisure time, significant time away from work where you're just enjoying doing something. But there are some experiences that give you those opportunities, and hiking is one of those experiences. And backpacking, even more so than hiking, because of the time spent on the trail, the time spent in camp, the time spent preparing, the time spent traveling. All of that together adds up to a lot of time between adults in a setting where they're really enjoying themselves, and it really does bring people closer. I say all that because in 2013, my family did a trip to the Three Sisters Wilderness in Oregon, and we went hiking with our good friends, the Kinsels. And I want to mention this because the Kinsel family has been an important part of our life. Their kids were born around the same time as our kids. They have a son who's the same age as my daughter. They have a daughter who's a year older than my son. And so we've spent a lot of time with them on camping trips and hiking trips, backpacking trips, and even a trek hiking together in Europe. In 2013, though, we hiked in the Three Sisters Wilderness for 4 days, I think it was. It was 3 nights on the trail. We spent one night near Sisters Mirror Lake and then 2 nights at Moraine Lake. We had planned to camp the third night at Green Lake, but the kids were having so much fun swimming around Moraine Lake that they didn't want to move camp the next day, and so we stayed there 2 nights. We also ended up hiking South Sister, which was a really tough day hike up from Moraine Lake, and we only had that opportunity because we didn't move camp the third day. In any event, that trip got me thinking about that area, and I thought it would be great to do an episode about this wonderful trail that loops around the entire Three Sisters Wilderness. One thing that I sometimes do when I'm backpacking is take notes about a trip. So I might have a little notepad. And what I found over time is I often don't take that many notes. I'm either too busy with camp chores or hiking or too tired or just enjoying the outdoors so much that I don't spend a lot of time writing. But when I go back and look at these notes, even the sparse notes that I do take are very meaningful to me. And I'm sure a lot of you who backpack and trek also keep journals when you do those trips. In any event, I thought it might be worthwhile to hear what I wrote one morning from our 2013 trip with the Kinsel family. It was August 13th, 2013. I wrote, 8:13, hiked 3.5 miles from Mirror Lake's trailhead to a small lake past Sisters Mirror Lake. Kids played Munchkin in the tent. Munchkin's a card game they used to love when they were younger. Justin fished, but no luck. Grant caught one, but never set the hook, and it got off, though he meant to release it anyway. Clouds built to the northeast yesterday, but they cleared by evening. Andy and I went for a walk around Sister Mirror Lake and met Tumbleweed from Austin, Texas, a PCT thru-hiker carrying a small travel guitar, approximately PCT mile 2000. Seven tents were set up in the meadow. Younger people, maybe teens, that arrived after us. Another guy with a dog packed up and left. We ended up with our lake to ourselves. At bedtime, Justin said he felt uncomfortable, so he cuddled with Andy and then went off to bed. Think he just wanted his bedtime routine from home, and maybe our tent was a little far from his. Andy seems to be enjoying herself, or at least tolerating it well. She doesn't get excited by any of this the way I do. She doesn't seem to like to be uncomfortable, and I seem to thrive on it. I got up this morning at what I thought was a reasonable hour, but it has been a long time now, over an hour, and no one else is up. I would normally be on the trail by now. Already had my tea and took care of the bathroom, and now I'm writing more than I ever write on a trip. Slept pretty well and didn't hike much yesterday, so I'm a bit restless with a touch of tired. So that's what I wrote the first morning after our first night in the Three Sisters Wilderness back in 2013. In 2020, during the pandemic, I went back to the Three Sisters Wilderness. This time I was hiking with my uncle. And my Uncle Larry is my mother's older brother. He's in his mid-70s, but he's been a very adventurous, outdoorsy person his whole life. He's a heck of a cyclist and cross-country skier. But recently he has gone back to backpacking. And this is the second time I had gone backpacking with him. And it was a great way for me to connect with a family member who I knew growing up, but never spent a lot of time with. And as I mentioned before, backpacking is an opportunity to really spend quality time with people. And so this past summer, I drove up to Oregon, and Larry drove down from Washington, where he lives. And we spent 3 days, 2 nights on the trail, camped at Green Lake, and really enjoyed ourselves. And like I was saying before, it was a great opportunity to deepen a relationship between me and another adult who, under typical circumstances, I wouldn't have the opportunity to spend so much quality time with. So I think you'll see on today's show that Katie Cook feels similarly about backpacking, and that although she was in a beautiful location, this wonderful volcanic wilderness, what was most significant to her, what stood out to her, and what she enjoyed most about the trip was the quality time she was able to spend with her friends. And so it is for many of us when we go backpacking. And I would even say that it's true when you go solo backpacking. It gives you quality time to spend with yourself that you might not otherwise get in your day-to-day life. So even when you don't go with anyone, you do get to deepen your relationship with someone, and that someone is you. These trips I went on in 2013 and 2020 were shorter trips, one with younger kids and another with an older hiker, and I really love these trips, but I also love the bigger circuits, and the point to points. And I really love the idea of hiking as a mode of transportation through the land. And so during our 2020 trip with my uncle, we did meet several hikers who were doing the loop. And so I thought, why not bring that adventure to Trails Worth Hiking? So now let's jump into it and talk a little bit about the history. Most of the history of the Three Sisters Wilderness is geologic history. And just like we've been talking about hiking with family, the Three Sisters Wilderness is the story of a family. They're three sisters, as we've said. There's Faith, Hope, and Charity. These are the names that have been given by Westerners to these three volcanoes in Oregon. And these volcanoes are part of the Cascade Volcanic Arc, which goes from Northern California through Oregon and Washington and even into British Columbia. It's about 700 miles or 1,100 kilometers of multiple volcanoes. It's one segment of the Cascade Mountain Range, and is part of the larger Pacific Ring of Fire. As many of you may know, if you're a little bit older like me, the last major eruption in this chain of mountains was Mount St. Helens in 1980, which was just a phenomenal explosion and eruption. And if you haven't seen it, you can find videos of it on YouTube. And if you ever go to this part of the West Coast, it's worth it to stop at Mount St. Helens and see what it looks like even today. You really do get a sense of the enormous destruction that happened there. The Three Sisters area is in the Willamette and Deschutes National Forests. And these three volcanoes are the third, fourth, and fifth highest peaks in Oregon. Each of them is over 10,000 feet or over 3,000 meters. They were formed during the Pleistocene, which is from about 2.5 million years ago up to the more recent Ice Age. So quite a large range of time, I know, but still fairly recent in geologic time. And as you might guess from where this chain of volcanoes is, it's formed from subduction from plate tectonics, meaning as the plate out in the Pacific Ocean goes under the continent, it pushes up these volcanoes that are a little bit inland, but still fairly close to the coast compared to most mountain ranges. So now let's talk about these three sisters. Faith is the oldest of the three and has the most erosion. She is 10,090 feet high, which is 3,075 meters, but was much higher once upon a time and last erupted 46,000 years ago in the late Pleistocene, so fairly recently in geologic time. And I've called these stratovolcanoes, but Faith is technically a shield volcano, which is more of a low-profile look to it, and apparently has more highly liquid lava flows. And I think the name shield is based on the fact that they look flatter on top, kind of like a shield lying on top of a hill. Hope, the middle sister, is a basaltic stratovolcano. So what is a stratovolcano? So this is a conical volcano built by layers of lava and tephra. So you have sequential outpourings that make composite layers. Essentially, every time it erupts, there's a new layer of lava that comes out, pours down all the sides and dries, and you create a layer that builds up. And then the next time it erupts, another layer is put on top of that layer, and so on and so on. Through this method, you have different strata. You have different layers that the volcano builds upon and by which it grows. Hope is 10,052 feet high or 3,064 meters. She is the smallest of the three. Her last eruptions were from about 25,000 to 18,000 years ago. And it was those eruptions that really built this mountain. Charity, which we call South Sister, is 10,363 feet or 3,159 meters high. And the current modern structure of this mountain is only about 50,000 years old. And Charity last erupted only about 2,000 years ago. It has an uneroded summit crater, and there's an actual small lake in there called Teardrop Pool. and there are glaciers going down the side of the mountain. When my daughter and I hiked to the top of South Sister, we saw the teardrop pool. I think it was iced over, or at least that's what my memory of it, but I do remember being surprised to see a lake in the top of the volcano. Notably, there are lots of other volcanoes in the immediate vicinity, and a lot of them do have names that associate them with the family of the Three Sisters. For example, there's Mount Bachelor, which is in view of the Three Sisters, and I guess according to legend is supposedly wooing one or two or all of the sisters. There's also another one called the Husband. I'm not sure how it works there with a bachelor and a husband. And then there's Broken Top and Three-Fingered Jack, and there may be others. The area where these volcanoes are is also heavily forested below the level of the conical volcanoes. There's a lot of Douglas fir and western hemlock. The area is rich with animals. There's black bear, deer, elk, squirrels, weasels, bobcat, mountain lion. A lot of the typical stuff you see in the mountains of the American West, and I imagine in much of America. But one thing that is a little different here out in the West, and particularly in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington, is you might have an opportunity to catch a glimpse of Bigfoot, also known as Sasquatch. So what is Bigfoot? Well, he's supposed to be a hairy humanoid, up to about 8 feet tall. So I guess that's probably about 2.5 meters. Very shy and elusive, not aggressive. Accounts of Bigfoot in Oregon go back to 1904. But the legend of Bigfoot really took off in the 1950s, based around logging culture. So you had a lot of these guys that were working in logging camps and would claim to have seen sightings of Bigfoot. And who knows? I don't know what they saw. And I'm not going to spend more time going into all the history of Bigfoot. There's a lot out there you can look into. But it is something that adds a lot of character and mystery to this part of the United States. And hey, you never know. Maybe someday you'll see him. The human history, not just the humanoid history, goes back quite a ways too in this area. East of the Cascades, there were the Northern Paiute Native Americans. They were a nomadic desert people. The rain shadow of the Cascades feeds into a high desert on the eastern side. The Northern Paiute ranged as far as the Great Basin Desert in western Nevada, southern Oregon, and the eastern part of California. They used a lot of the obsidian, the volcanic obsidian in the area, for their arrowheads. Obsidian is a black volcanic glass that's formed by certain lava flows that cool really quickly. And so that's something that the natives were able to use from the volcanic landscape to help them hunt. The first person of European ancestry who talks about this area is Peter Skern Ogden of the Hudson Bay Company. In 1825, he came through this area. He was a British-Canadian fur trader. Notably, he married a Native American woman and then later in life married another woman for his second marriage, and that woman was also a Native American woman. Also, Ogden, Utah, which I believe today is basically a suburb or nearby city to Salt Lake City, Utah, is named after him. In any event, he was the first Westerner to write about this area and the Three Sisters. The main town near this area is Bend, Oregon. In 1834, Nathaniel Wyeth and his group of beaver trappers came through this area and camped, spent time there. In 1877, there was the Farewell Bend Ranch that was built along a bend in the Deschutes River. And there's a recording of that ranch being purchased, and that's the first time the name Bend shows up anywhere. And Bend, Oregon became a town in 1904. There was a railroad that was connected to the area, and that brought both logging and tourism. I should mention that today, Bend, Oregon is quite a city. It's about 100,000 people and has grown quite a bit over the last 20 years. the metropolitan area is about 200,000 people. It's Central Oregon's largest city, and it's the fifth largest metropolitan area in Oregon. Bend has a pretty nice downtown. It has a thriving craft beer scene. It's right there on the Deschutes River, a really beautiful spot. And even in the two times that I went to Bend in 2013 and 2020, I've seen quite a bit of changes. In 2020, although it's hard to know because of the pandemic whether I was getting a sort of accurate look at things, but one thing I did notice is that a lot of the area has been built up. And there were a lot of nice homes that were recently built. The area seems to be growing still. And so Bend, Oregon is somewhat of a refuge for people from California, people from Portland, people from Seattle. And really, its location in view of the Three Sisters Wilderness is part of what makes it so attractive as a place to go. The area that is today the Three Sisters Wilderness is a protected space and has been for quite a while. In 1892, President Grover Cleveland created the Cascade Forest Reserve, which protected the Cascades from the Columbia River to Northern California. In 1907, it became the Cascade National Forest. In 1937, it was protected as a primitive area. And then finally, in 1964, it was protected by the Wilderness Act. And the Three Sisters Wilderness has been expanded twice even since then. All right, so that gives you a little background on the area. One thing before we jump into the interview, I just wanted to mention that I used the term PCT in my notes that I read of my family's 2013 trip to the Three Sisters Wilderness. And with Katie Cook, we also refer to the PCT several times. Most of you know that's the Pacific Crest Trail, the 2,650-mile trail that goes from the Mexican border to the Canadian border through California, Oregon, and Washington. But not all of you know that, so I just want to point that out, that when we refer to the PCT, we're talking about the Pacific Crest Trail. So now let's jump into my conversation with Katie Cook about the Three Sisters Loop. Katie Cook, welcome to Trails Worth Hiking. Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jeremy.
So tell me about Trees and Tents.
So Trees and Tents started off as just a personal blog, a way for me to catalog my favorite hikes in the Bay Area, because I have a really horrible memory and I would hike the same park over and over and I'd be like, didn't I do this before? I don't know. So it started that way, and then it kind of evolved. And now there's gear guides up there, multi-day backpacking, trip reports. I have a series of stickers that I just make kind of for myself again to memorialize trails, and I have those up there for sale. It's just a hobby and a passion of mine.
So that's interesting. It started out as day hikes, but pretty quickly it seems like it evolved into featuring backpacking trips.
Yeah. Well, you know, hiking itineraries take a lot of time to write. And so I hike a lot, and I don't have the time to make all those itineraries anymore. So now I feel like the backpacking trips require so much planning. It's so hard to remember everything, even day to day. On a week-long trip, I look back and I'm like, wow, what happened on day one?
Right.
So yeah, that's why there's more backpacking on there now.
Well, one of the things I thought was really neat is you also had a lot of information for people just starting out in backpacking, and you also have a pretty much a focus on women backpackers. Can you talk a little bit about your decision to do that?
Yeah, so that all stemmed from 2017. I hiked the John Muir Trail, and I hiked it with a friend, and I noticed that there really weren't a lot of women in the backcountry. And the women that were there were hiking with their boyfriends or their husbands, but not a lot of like either solo women or women hiking in groups together. And I just thought, I was like, this needs to change. These women are missing out. And so I really started to reach out to people, and I was like, why don't you do some backpacking? And it came down to a lot of women didn't have people to hike with, or if they were interested in maybe going solo, you know, their friends or their family would just be like, no, that's too dangerous. You're going to die. Don't do it. And so I started focusing on giving information to women because I want them to be able to go out there, and if they don't have anyone to hike with, to have the confidence and the skills to organize their own group to go backpacking with. They don't need to wait to be invited to something. They can be the leaders and have the skills to do it confidently.
And what are some of the resources you provide for people who go to the site?
So I have like a 5-day how to plan your first trip. I'm actually thinking about doing a course, and I hope to get that up this spring, because I've noticed that with COVID, there's so many more people who are interested in backpacking. But it's already kind of an expensive hobby with the gear. And then a lot of the courses that are out there, you know, a few $100s. And so I would love something that's under $100, builds a community, gives you all the skills from just all the mistakes I made. I remember I bought a 0-degree sleeping bag and then a like ultra lightweight pad that had no insulation.
So on one hand, you're too warm and the other hand, you're freezing.
Yeah. I didn't understand how everything worked together, what I really needed or how to evaluate a trail. So I want to give women that insight, because that's really hard to find on the internet. There's so much noise out there.
And so you've got trip reports where people can help plan a trip for themselves. You've also got gear guides on the right kind of gear to bring. This may seem kind of silly, but the thing that was most interesting to me was the stickers in one way, because I think that's like a cool thing to have a little memento. Are you designing the stickers yourself?
I'm not illustrating them myself, but I design them myself. I work with an artist. And those stickers, I give her like a preliminary sketch or most likely a bunch of photos. I'm like, this is my favorite spot on the trail, and here's why I like it. And we do a few iterations until she kind of has, you know, my image in there.
That's cool. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good way for me to reflect.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that I was thinking about is when you were mentioning getting women into the backcountry who aren't comfortable doing that, is I was thinking of a good friend of mine, and she's a really adventurous person. She has traveled all over the world. She's done several treks in Nepal and actually hooked me up with a guide who I used when I went to Nepal and did a trek there. But she doesn't go backpacking.
Really?
And it blows my mind that she is not comfortable with the idea of just taking everything on her back and sleeping out in a tent. And so what would you say to someone like that who's really an adventurous person, but for whatever reason has sort of kept some boundaries around it, never really gone to the going backcountry, you know, even with friends, she doesn't go and backpack. She's never sort of crossed that threshold. What would you say to somebody like that?
God, well, I would say they should just try it. I feel like a lot of people, one of the things that turns people off is, you know, carrying everything. And they think that they need everything. And that's why the first time, if you've never been backpacking before, I always say, like, start with a one night short trip. You're gonna overpack. You're gonna bring way too much food. You're gonna be way too much water. You're gonna think that you need a big chair to sit on. You're gonna have some wrong gear that's really heavy, and it's gonna be miserable carrying it. And then you're gonna realize that you didn't use like half the things you brought, and you really don't need them. You know, I think that helps seeing people's fears, realizing that their fears aren't a big deal. It really helps them. And then a short one, there's no pressure. You know, if you don't like it, you can't sleep, you're afraid of the dark, whatever it is, you could just get up and pack up and walk those 2 miles to your car in the middle of the night, you know?
That's good advice. I think really that's how I got my kids into backpacking, was sort of little trips. They got, you know, a little bit longer each year, and one more night added each year, and then maybe a little bit more distance, and they had to carry a little bit more gear. And then ultimately they got to a point where they were really comfortable no matter where we went. And I think it works the same with adults. They can start out with something small. So I think that's great advice.
Yeah.
How did you originally get into backpacking?
I didn't grow up backpacking. I grew up camping, like car camping with my family. And then in 2009, a friend invited me to do the Inca Trail in Peru. And I really didn't know anything. I didn't have a good idea of what that even meant when I said I would go, honestly. And so that was kind of backpacking light. You know, we had a Sherpa, so we only had to carry a day pack. But we did, you know, it was hiking every day. We did sleep in a tent every night, but we didn't have to cook our own meals. But after doing that, it was the experience. It wasn't getting to Machu Picchu. I actually was very disappointed by Machu Picchu.
Too many people.
Yeah. But it was on the way to Machu Picchu and all those experiences and spending time with friends completely disconnected from everything else that was happening in the world and no distractions. You just build, your friendships grow so much stronger. And that really made me interested in seeing, okay, you know, what else is out there? I can do this.
What did you end up doing for your first backpacking trip?
So my first backpacking trip, I did a single overnight in Yellowstone.
Okay, that's perfect place to go.
Yeah. I had to go out there for a friend's wedding. And so a group of us had, you know, two extra days and we went out to Yellowstone and none of us were very good backpackers. We probably spent an hour trying to do a bear hang.
Right.
But it was great. And I got hooked and I've kind of been obsessed with it ever since.
That's great. So we're here today to talk about the Three Sisters Loop and the Three Sisters Wilderness. So how did you end up deciding to do that trail?
So that trail, it was actually organized by a friend, that trip. And there were four of us hiking, well, five including myself, and three of us from the Bay Area, two from Seattle. So that trail was a good midpoint for everyone to meet up. And I, you know, she suggested this. I did a Google search of the photos. I saw how beautiful it was. And I said, yes.
So once it was decided that you were going to do this trip, were you involved with the planning or did your friend get to do all the planning?
We didn't really do a lot of planning. We looked into permits as a group. We looked at weather. We looked at water as a group. And that was it. And then we all met in Bend like 2 days before the trip and had a big strategy session where we hammered everything out, but we didn't do a ton of planning. And I hate to say that because this is a trip that I think goes better if you plan.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of options, right? There's a lot of places you can start the trip and a lot of places you can, you know, there's different, you can go both directions. There's a lot of things that can, there's a lot of decision points, it seems like, in deciding how to do it.
There are, yeah. There's a lot. And yeah, when I look back on it now, there were definitely some crossroad points where, you know, we thought a water supply was going to be reliable, but it wasn't. So it meant we had to go on to camp somewhere else or a side trip we didn't get to do because of the heat and the terrain. And we could have planned better, but it was still a great trip.
I feel like that kind of thing happens on every trip. Like there's always going to be that thing that you had no idea was going to happen. Sometimes that something like that will happen every single day of a trip, but it always seems to work out. But you're right. It creates challenges when you are expecting a water source to be there, for example, and it's not, and you have to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
So what time of year should people be thinking about doing this trip? Is this pretty much a pure summer trip?
This is a pure summer trip. Yeah. Cause there's a lot of snow up there. So you know, depending on the year, I think people could probably go as early as May on a low snow year. But we went early August and it was a high snow year and there were tons of mosquitoes. So I would almost suggest that people go later, like mid-August into September, just unless you like mosquitoes.
I've been to the Three Sisters Wilderness for backpacking twice. And I think I just got lucky both times because I don't think I had huge mosquitoes, but maybe they weren't big snow years. And so the mosquitoes might be gone by August. And I don't even remember what month we went, but I think it was maybe late July, early August. But yeah, it's like the Sierra, right? If you hit it, if you time it wrong, it can be really awful with mosquitoes. So but if you time it correctly, you've hardly noticed them.
Yeah.
And so what can people expect as far as weather? What does the Central Oregon sort of weather look like for backpacking? I mean, you've got this sort of really wet part of Oregon that's on the west of the Cascades, but you've got high desert on the east. So what does it look like right in the Cascades themselves?
So I was actually surprised at how hot it was. We weren't during a heat wave, and so it was in the high 80s, low 90s during the day. Our first day, though, was really warm, really humid, and then that afternoon, we got a lightning hailstorm, and so the weather was all over the place, but it was a lot hotter than I expected. So people should be prepared for that, because it isn't coastal weather. It's warm.
Yeah, I mean, you're right against the desert, so I could see how it could be very hot. I think the times I was there, it was pretty pleasant. Like, it wasn't ridiculously hot, but it was definitely warm in the summer. And the nights were cool, but not really that cold. Even though you're further north in California, the elevations aren't really that high. So you don't get to the kind of, 10,000-foot campsites that you might get in the Sierra, where it can get really, really cold at night.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think it got below like 50 at night when we were there.
Oh, wow. That is pretty warm.
Yeah, it was warm.
And so what about time and distance for this hike? What should people be thinking about?
So it's really up to the people. Like, we did it in 5 days, but we chose that because one person in our group, this was their first backpacking trip. And so we tried to limit the distance. We didn't really want to do more than 10 miles a day. And so that's why we did the 5-day itinerary. But a lot of people go out there and they can do it in 3 or even, less if you're really pounding out the miles. But there's so much to see. I always say, why hurry? Take your time.
Yeah, I guess it's good to know, though, if you have limited time and you want to do it in a, Thursday through Sunday kind of trip and rush up there from the Bay Area or down from Seattle, you could do it over 3 or 4 days if you wanted to. But like you said, but if you've got more time, why not use it?
Yeah. And it's not like the Sierras that we're used to, because, the elevation isn't as high. So you don't really need to get acclimated as much. There's not as much climbing.
So the trail is about 50 miles or about 80 kilometers. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So we were using 2 maps. We used a National Geographic Trails Atlas for the Three Sisters, and then I think the other one was called Adventure Ready. And those maps, they were always off every day. It was like 1 to 3 miles difference. So I think the trail is around 47 miles, and then depending on where you enter, that usually tacks on another 2 to 3 miles.
Okay. Yeah, I remember, I think I used the Adventure map or whatever it's called, like you said, Adventure Ready. I'm not sure what the name is. And that's the one that has on one side, it's got the entire area. And on the back side, it's got a more close up of sort of the more popular part of the area, right?
Yeah, I loved that map. I love the close up.
Yeah, very helpful. I'll tell you a funny story. When we first went there with our kids, when I think it was 2013, we hiked only in that area that's on the blow up map. And I used the map the entire weekend without realizing that the blow up was on the backside. So it was completely lost on me that there was actually a better map. In any event, it worked out fine. So what should people be thinking about as far as gear? I mean, we've got a sort of, your sort of standard 3-season mountain backpacking gear. That's going to work pretty well for this, it would seem like.
Yeah, it's going to work really well. Yeah, I think I had a 30-degree bag, and I was plenty warm. I'm not truly lightweight, but I do try to, pack as light as possible just to make things a little more fun, less painful. But yeah, the typical backpacking gear, you will need a water filter, and maybe because there's water carries, a filter or a filter setup that gives you a large capacity to filter at once, because there are some carries.
When you say carries, you mean there's some areas where you're going to have to go long stretches without water, so you want to be able to store quite a bit.
Exactly, yes.
Okay. What about bear cans? I know in the Sierra, that's something we pretty much have to use in most places, but is that something that you recommend people bring for this part of Oregon?
So they're not required, but I recommend it only because there's not always a place to hang if you're relying on a bear bag, and there are bears. And so especially if you need to camp in any of the burn areas, there really isn't a place to hang on any of those trees. So I just think a can is just easier rather than, after a long day searching for a place to stash their bear bag.
So you mentioned the burn areas. That's something that I was aware of one burn area, and I can't remember exactly. It's when you go up over the hill past Green Lake, and on the other side, I know there's a big burn area. But you mentioned that there's also a more recent, I think you told me there was a more recent burn area in another part of the trail.
Yeah.
What are the burn areas like, and what should is that? How does that figure into planning or thinking about this trip?
So the burn areas are one of the challenging parts of the trip, just in terms of planning it, because so on the east side, there's the burn area from the Pole Creek fire, and that fire was massive. It burned like 41 square miles. And so there's a really long stretch of trail where there really isn't good camping unless you camp in a burn area one night or do a 4-mile offshoot to one of the lakes that are off the trail. And then on the western side of the trail, there's a more recent burn area. And that was, I think, the 2017 Horse Creek fire or Horse Creek complex, something like that. But that one wasn't mapped at all because it happened in 2017. So the maps hadn't caught up with it yet. And so that was a big surprise. And that's about 3 miles on that stretch.
Okay, so it sounds like the Pole Creek fire burn area is a pretty significant concern as far as where you're going to camp. And that's something people should definitely think about when they plan their campsites.
Exactly, yeah. And some people even enter at, I forget what the trailhead is, but there's a trailhead that enters right in the middle of the burn zone. And some people choose to do that so that they don't need to camp within the burn zone. And then they can hike around it. But I don't know, then you're starting the trip and ending the trip in the burn zone.
Not the prettiest part of the trail.
Yeah.
So I think we're underselling it for people here. We're talking about all these burn zones. Can you describe for people? I mean, this area is fantastically beautiful with volcanic mountains, huge conical volcanoes. Maybe you can talk a little bit about just what this area looks like.
Yeah. Oh my God. So this area is absolutely stunning. This trail, it almost feels like you're hiking 5 different trails because the scenery is so different from one end to the other. Like you start off and, you know, you might walk next to Alpine Lakes and you see the sisters jutting up in the background and you're surrounded by pine trees and it's really beautiful. And the mountains themselves are beautiful. Like they're nothing like I've ever seen before. I'm used to Sierra granite, that, you know, white, gray kind of illuminating mountain. These are so colorful. It's red and orange, some like greeny blues. And every time you walk by and you look up and you notice like another color or a new glacier, and the glaciers are so obvious because the mountains are so colorful. It's like these white patches amongst them. And then there's, like you said, the whole volcanic area. And so those cinder cones that are massive anthills, sandy looking anthills. You just look at and you're just like, wow, I've never seen anything like this. And yeah, massive lava fields and just gorgeous.
And the lava fields, some of them are different from each other, where some of them seem to be really old and kind of brown and others are more red and then others are almost black in places. I mean, it's a really, like you said, I think the colors here are something that's really interesting.
Yeah. I remember there was a part of the trail where it was red and big boulders, and you kind of felt like you were in the Southwest, you know, hiking in Arizona or New Mexico. And then you get to, yeah, the black lava fields, and you're like, am I in Hawaii?
So how do people get there? So from California, from Northern California, where you are, this is pretty much just a straight freeway shot all the way up to Bend, Oregon. Is that the easiest way to do it?
Yeah, so you could fly to Bend. We had another 2-week backpack trip planned right before this one, and that fell through. And so we took 2 weeks and we just did small backpacking trips, and we did a long drive and explored just tons of parks on our way. And that was pretty awesome. You obviously don't need 2 weeks, but if you do the drive, you get to pass by Crater Lake, Newberry Volcanic Park, all the redwoods, if you want to take a short, you know, detour on the one. There's a lot to see, and the drive is gorgeous.
Now I have to ask, where did you go backpacking during that 2 weeks?
So we did some time in Trinity Alps. We did Jedediah Redwoods. Where else did we do? Oh, we did some around Crater Lake and some out by Lassen in the McLeod River.
Yeah, yeah. Area. That's all great. That's all great stuff. Trinity Alps are a great place to go also. That's one of my favorite mountain ranges.
Yeah, that trip was the first time I'd ever been there. And I loved it.
And so are there permits required to do this hike?
So they just instituted permits. If you want to hike between May 25th and the end of September, I think it's like September 28th, you need to get a permit in advance. And they're doing permits on recreation.gov. And right now they're opening up the permits, and then they are, instead of doing walk-ups because of COVID, they're going to release more permits within 7 days of the trip. So there's a chance for people, if they don't get a permit early on, they can apply and see if there's a permit within 7 days of their starting trip, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. This whole new system is because this area is just so popular now, right?
It's so popular, yeah. People day hike the South Sister all the time. You can day hike up to the summit. And then it's just a really easy one day to get out to some of those lakes. And so people do day hikes around those lakes. And then, you know, the backpacking as well.
We hiked South Sister, but from Moraine Lake. We were camped at Moraine Lake. And we went We did South Sister from there. That was back when, in 2013, when my daughter was 13 at the time, she and I made it to the top. That was fun. It's a beautiful, beautiful view from up there.
You know, so that's my one regret. We were going to save the summit for the last day, and then we decided to get beer and pizza instead.
That doesn't seem like a terrible decision. And you know what? The South Sister will still be there.
Exactly, yeah.
And what about the Obsidian area? There's the Obsidian part of this trip. Does that require a separate permit, or do you just kind of push through it all in one day to avoid that, or how does that work?
Yeah, so if you want to camp within the Obsidian area, you need to get a permit. Otherwise, you need to remain. It's the PCT at that point, and you can't leave the PCT and just need to hike through, no camping in that zone.
Okay. And then also there's passes required to park a car, from what I remember. I think you have to get a local, like a Deschutes Forest Pass or something like that.
Deschutes Forest Pass. Although we had a National Parks Pass, like the America the Beautiful or whatever, and that worked too.
That makes sense. So National Park Pass would work. And I think it's the other thing that they have up there. It's called the Pacific Northwest something. There's some kind of name for that pass that covers several national forests in the area, which I think I just ordered online a few weeks before. This is in my trip I went last year. I have an uncle that lives up in Washington. And so he came down and I drove up and we did the same kind of thing where we met halfway. And it was crazy because I'm hiking with somebody who's in his mid 70s and he's keeping up with me. Which was impressive. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, props to Uncle Larry.
So was the permit, you did that last year?
So that was 2020, during the pandemic. And they actually had planned to implement the permit system before that season, but because of the pandemic, decided to wait. So we did not need a permit.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
All right. So let's talk now about the trail itself and the hike itself. You guys decided to start at Devil's Lake Trailhead. So tell me about what was the thought that went into doing it that way.
So we did it because from there we wouldn't need to summit South Sister on the first day if we didn't want to, and we could save it for the last day. We all know how that went. So that's why we decided to start there. And so that is the most popular trailhead. So that parking at that time was an issue. I don't know if it would be now with the permit system, but it is a little bit of a uphill. Like it's, I think, 1,200 feet of elevation in the first 2 miles, but it's all really a shady forest. So it's not, you know, you don't have the sun beating down on you or anything.
I think the reason that one's a very popular trailhead is that's because people day hike South Sister from there, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, but you also, with their new permit system, you need a permit to do a day hike now, too.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
And just so people know, this is about a 30-mile trip, or about almost 50-kilometer trip from Bend, Oregon, if you're to get to the trailhead itself. By the way, you guys came up from other hiking trips you were doing along the way. Did you spend a night at a campground, a car campground, or a night in Bend or something before you did the hike?
We got an Airbnb in Bend before we did the hike. Yeah. And, you know, it's such a short distance. It's really easy to get to from Bend.
Exactly.
There is a car camping spot at Devil's Lake. So if people wanted to car camp, they could car camp right at the trailhead.
And that wasn't full when you got there? Or do you know, you're not sure?
Well, I don't know. Since we didn't do it, I have a feeling you need to do reservations. I don't think it's walk-ups.
Okay. When I went last summer with my uncle, everything was booked up because so many people during the pandemic were going backpacking and hiking. Everything was booked. And I went through a website called Hip Camp. I don't know if you've heard about it, but it's basically like Airbnb for camping. And so we found a private property owner that rented us a spot to camp on the night before.
Oh, that's great. Right in the national forest or just outside of it?
It was kind of outside of Bend. It was a little ways out of Bend, but it wasn't in the national forest. It was on private property. I think the way Hip Camp works, they have a requirement that the property has to be a certain size. They don't want it in urban areas, but so it may have been a 5-acre lot that the home was on or something like that. And they had 2 or 3 campsites that they were renting out to people. And there was another couple there who had a small RV that was in one of the other spots. And then we stayed there the night before and it worked out just fine. But you do have to be creative if the campgrounds are full or if you don't want to try to do a walk up, and because that might be something you can't count on. You might show up and all the sites are full. And if you've driven from Bend all the way out to the middle of the mountains and you can't get a spot, it's kind of a problem.
Yeah, it's risky. Yeah. But Hip Camp, yeah, it's a great alternative because I agree. You have to be creative now with everyone else doing outdoorsy things.
Yes. Not that I'm complaining. I think everyone should be outdoors.
Me neither.
Okay. So the question that I wanted to ask is, why did you decide to do this trip counterclockwise versus clockwise?
I don't think there was any thought to it. And I was looking at the elevation profile today of the entire trip. And I was like, it actually looks easier going clockwise.
So you guys just wanted to make it harder on yourselves.
We just wanted to make it harder.
All right, so you start at Devil's Lake Trailhead, and you go to Green Lakes the first day, and that's about 7.7 miles or 12.5 kilometers. And as you mentioned, there's that uphill climb at the beginning going up the trailhead to kind of get into the mountains. And then you start going counterclockwise. And tell me about what that day is like. What are you seeing? What's the sort of, you know, what's the itinerary like?
Yeah, well, so after you get to that junction where you can either continue to the summit or start the whole backpacking counterclockwise or clockwise loop, it's really gorgeous. Going counterclockwise, you pass by all these lakes. When we went, there were wildflowers everywhere, bushes of lupin and bloom, and all the lakes are just really gorgeous. It's not lush in a sense, you know, it still has that volcanic feel. So there's all this like really dark rock in between the grasses and the meadows. That's really cool.
And you ended up deciding to camp at Green Lake?
So Green Lake is actually a series of 3 lakes. And so we camped at the last lake. And the way that the trail works is for most of it, it's open camping. But at the lakes, you do need to camp in designated sites. And so I think Green Lakes, there's like 28 different sites all around. So we were able to find one that was open. Because if there isn't a site, you're technically supposed to move on.
Okay. And so, yeah, I remember that. We camped there last summer at Green Lakes with my uncle. And we found a site right by the main Green Lake. But it was probably the last site that was available when we got there. And I remember what you're talking about. There's the third lake beyond. And there's a couple of sites there. So you've got to hope that you can get there early enough in the day, it sounds like, to get a site. Or you could stop even at Moraine Lake before that, which has sites as well.
Exactly, yeah.
And then your second day, you decided to go from Green Lakes to Alder Creek, which is 12.5 miles or about 20 kilometers. So tell me about how that day went.
So that day, it starts off really gorgeous. Like, you get the first peak of middle sister and north sisters you're walking. And, you know, we had the sun was glinting off of the mountains and it was really pretty. And then you kind of enter in like this meadow with a little creek running through it. And then you get to the burn zone. And it's still, I don't want to be negative and keep focusing on the burn zone, because even though it is a burn zone, it's still kind of cool. Like, we met another hiker and he gave the best description. He was like, kind of feels like you're walking on the moon, because it's this really dark sand that's coarse sand. And, you know, everything is kind of has some potholes just because of the way the sand kind of has fallen, and there's, you know, everything is wind blown. And
so it's just yet another look that you get from this area that you, I mean, it's so many different appearances. Like you were saying before, you kind of go around a corner and it feels like you're in a different, completely different area. It's not, definitely not a consistent look throughout. It changes quite a bit.
Yeah, you feel like you're in a different park every day.
And you ended up camping at Alder Creek. Is that in the burn zone?
It's in the burn zone.
So is this like camping? Yeah. Is this like camping in Mordor in Lord of the Rings or something?
Yeah, it totally is. And if you're like me and you're afraid of widowmakers or camping by dead trees, you're not going to sleep at all that night.
I am like that. I get totally freaked out by that. And I do that all the time where I'll set up my tent and then I'll pull it all down and move it because I realize I set up right under some tree that's leaning over me.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was a hard choice because at the last junction that has water, we decided to go on to Alder Creek because someone had told us that there were really nice camp spots there. Because you have the choice. You could go on to Alder Creek or you could go off the main trail, like 4.5 miles to one of the other lakes that are outside the burn zones. And I've heard the lakes are also really gorgeous. But we decided to go on to Alder Creek based on someone's recommendation. And I don't know where they camped.
But it wasn't where you camped.
It wasn't where we camped.
That's one of the fun things about backpacking is there's not many things left in the world where you can get sort of word of mouth while it's happening. And maybe it works out, maybe it doesn't. But it's still kind of a neat thing, I think, to travel that way where you're away from technology at that point and it's hard to sort of figure it out online or whatever you would do at home. But somebody says, oh, yeah, I heard there's this great thing ahead and you should check it out. And then you do. And like you said, maybe it's what you think it is. Maybe it isn't. But there's just not a lot of mystery left in life. And so I find that to be fun.
It is really fun.
All right. So and then on the third day, you're going from Alder Creek to the end of the Obsidian Zone. So you're going through the entire Obsidian Zone. That's one part of this trail that I've never been to. So tell me a little bit about what that's like.
Oh, it was my favorite part of the trail. So that part of the trail is, again, feels like you're in four different parks. You walk through, like right after the burn zone, you get to these beautiful red rocks and red boulders. And then you get to the junction of the PCT and another lake up there. And then if you keep going, that's when the whole volcanic and cinder cone area begins. And the pass that you go over, well, you go over technically two passes. But Opie Dildock Pass, which is the biggest pass on this trip, was just my favorite part of the whole trail. It is just so cool.
Why is it so cool?
So you get a view, you kind of look down into this crater for a bit. You get a view all the way up northern Oregon and the buttes. And then there's just rock everywhere. And big lava rock, chunky lava rock. And that's what the trail's made out of, is just everywhere. And you just, I'm not a rock nerd, but I kind of became a rock nerd off of this trail. I just, it's like, what caused this? Like, I know it volcanic, but I was just trying to picture the lava flow and where it went and how everything was formed. And it's just really fascinating. And one other thing that I really loved was, so after you go down off of Opie Dildock Pass, you get into this zone and there's a ravine and you're walking next to a ravine. It's not like particularly deep, but it's probably about 20 feet across. And on one side, the side that you're walking on, it's this lush forest, lush pine forest with ferns. And then right on the other side of the ravine, all lava. It's just so cool.
A lot of the lava that you see in this area, it looks like it just cooled yesterday. You know, like it was hot 2 days ago or something. And all of a sudden, it's just now it's rock. And so nothing is growing in some of it.
Right. Yeah. No, it's completely bare. And so it was such a mind trip. You know, you're on this really lush forested side and then just right on the other side of this ravine, there's nothing growing.
So that night you guys ended up actually dry camping. Tell me about how that worked out or how that came to be.
Yeah. So right at the Obsidian Zone, there's a water source. There's a waterfall right at the end of the Obsidian Zone and little creek. And we knew that we just couldn't make it to the next water source. So we camped about a mile outside of the Obsidian Zone. We found actually a really nice campsite. It was kind of up on a ledge and it was really flat and nice, but we did have to haul in. We hauled in like 12 liters of water for our group of five because it had to last us, yeah, that night and into the day.
That's one of the cool things about dry camping though, is you can just pick whatever spot you want. Normally you're definitely limited by a water source. Although you've got to carry all this water a mile or whatever it is, at least you can pick a spot that's perfect for you.
Exactly. Yeah. And there isn't a ton of elevation. So we weren't carrying the water, you know, up a big hill or anything. So it wasn't so bad.
And then day four, you're going a little over 8 miles or about 13 kilometers. And you're going from this end of the Obsidian Zone area to Mesa Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on? That's following the PCT that day.
Yeah, so you're on the PCT that day. And what's really cool is for people who haven't hiked the PCT or the JMT, there's this kind of community aspect of it that I really love. And so at all the water stops on this side, you know, we're stopping and it's all these PCT hikers. And I just love talking to them about their trip and things that they've seen.
That's a timing thing too, right? Like depends where you are on the PCT and what time of year you hit it. I could see if you're in August in Oregon, you're going to hit people going northbound. So you're at a good time to catch the through hikers that are coming through. Like other times you can be on the PCT. Like if you were in Southern California on the PCT that same month, you wouldn't see anybody who was a through hiker because they have all 1,000 miles north.
Yeah.
So it's definitely time dependent because that whole community kind of moves like a traveling circus all at once, you know, which I did. I did the JMT back in 2011 and I did like that about it. It's fun to have that community of hikers that are all out there doing the same thing from day to day. And then when you do treks in places like Nepal or Europe, you get a lot of the same kind of feel because people are kind of following an itinerary that's roughly similar. So you tend to see people over days and that can really make it fun and create some friendships along the way.
Yeah, yeah. So this day going from Obsidian Zone to Mesa Creek, there's all sorts of little streams along the way. And since we had a short day, you know, 8 miles, we weren't really in a rush. And so we took a lot of time to like chit chat and stop and talk to folks. And then the trek itself through this day, I remember there were a lot of really lush meadows with wildflowers. You have the sisters on the east side of you. And then I believe this is when you first get your first glimpse of the husband. Because this whole area, everything is kind of named after. It's like a family. You know, you have the mother, the husband, the three sisters, the brother.
And the bachelor. Yeah, he's trying to woo the three sisters, apparently.
Yeah. So, yeah, so you really, it was the first time that we saw a parent.
How was Mesa Creek as far as an area to camp?
It was really nice. So there's lots of really flat spots to camp. The water, it's a little creek, but it has ice cold water, perfect for soaking your feet in. Yeah, we spent a lot of that time there because we got there early and we just, you know, hung out, played games. Tried to eat all of our food.
Yeah, it's nice to have a sort of half afternoon off sometimes and where you can do that, enjoy yourself a little bit, take it a little bit slower.
Yeah.
And that sounds like the last day was pretty much just going back to the car. It was about 6.5 miles roughly, or about 10 kilometers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The last day we just went back to the car. But that last day, again, you feel like you're in a different park because then you're going through the, oh gosh, what is it called? The something meadow or plains.
Oh, the Wikiup. Yeah. Plains. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember those. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so gorgeous. It's just like this vast green and...
But kind of sparse, almost desert looking, if I'm... Am I remembering it right, or is that different?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's kind of sparse, but then there's... Well, at least when we were there, there was grass as well,
okay.
Like short grass. So, yeah. But it was really gorgeous.
So if somebody were to ask you, why is this a trail I should go hike? What do you tell them?
I would say you're not going to get bored on this trail. Every day is going to be something new. Even sometimes halfway through the day, it's going to be like you're in a different park. So if you're the type of person who gets bored, like I know my boyfriend, if we go through just like a forest multiple days, it's like, oh, when is this going to be over?
Yeah, like an East Coast hike that they call the Appalachian Trail, but some people call it the tree tunnel.
Yes,
it's just the same through the forest forever. But yeah, this is definitely not that.
Yeah.
And so was there a particular memory or particular part of the trip that you loved the most? I know you mentioned a couple of things, but what really stands out as your sort of highlight of the trip?
You know, honestly, a big part of backpacking is the relaxing and the having fun. So the afternoon at Mesa Creek was the best. Because it's so nice just to relax and hang out with your friends and just, you know, enjoy the scenery.
And there's something about being in a place like we were talking about a little bit before, where there's no connection to anything to the outside world, where you really just have each other.
Yes. Yeah.
Anything happen on this trip that you didn't expect or anything you would have done differently now that you've done the trip?
Well, we definitely did not expect the lightning and hailstorm that we got on the first day. And then, yeah, the water, not having every water source that we thought was going to be reliable. And that was also kind of cool because there were some water sources that felt like they were pouring directly from glaciers. So they had that kind of icy blue look to them with that glacial silt.
So what would you tell people about the water situation? Is it really just if you're going to go in August that late in the season, to be careful about the sources? I mean, I'm wondering if there's something they could think about in looking at the maps, or is it obvious on the kind of places that are not reliable? Or as you look back on it, is there something you could have done to prepare for that?
Yeah, we thought that we had prepared for it because we had gotten some intel off of the internet on what water sources are reliable. But again, it's just, you know, sometimes we could have filtered at some of those places. But then you risk the chance of, well, do I want to possibly clog my filter on day two? I don't know. But I do have a thing on my blog where I've mapped all of our water sources, and they can download a Caltopo track with all of our reliable water sources that we found on there.
That's right. I remember seeing that now that you say that. So that's good advice to people. They can check that out. And I think maybe one thing that they can do is just carry a little bit extra, right? Like just when you get to a good water source, maybe load up a little more than you normally would. And even if that means carrying a couple of extra pounds weight, it's going to make you feel a lot more secure when you get to a stream that's a trickle in the mud.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially if you get there while it's hot, like we were going to be needing that water.
All right. Anything else that we should talk about on this trip? Anything else you want to mention?
God, no, I don't think so. I feel like we covered it.
So while I have you though, I've got a few more questions.
Okay.
So what's the next trip on your list?
So I'm actually heading back to Oregon, and we're going to do the Rogue River.
Is there a backpack along the Rogue River, or are you going to do it as a river trip?
There's a backpack along the Rogue River.
Oh, cool.
And it's about 40 miles.
Oh, neat. I didn't know about that.
Yeah. It starts near the town of Agnes, and it goes to Gold Beach.
And so what's the plan for how many days?
We're going to do it, Wednesday through Saturday. So what is that, 4 days?
So I'm just going to hazard a guess that you're not going to have a problem with water on this trip.
Yeah. Water should be really plentiful.
All right. Well, I'm curious to hear how that goes. I'll look for your report on your site.
Yes.
So what is a backpacking meal you could eat every day when you're backpacking?
I'm going to promote it a bit. Bushka's Kitchen, woman-owned business in San Francisco. She makes really great backpacking meals, but the one I love is her unstuffed pepper. And that I could eat every day. I've even eaten it like for lunch at home sometimes.
Is her stuff available online?
It's available online. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
So you could buy it, yeah, through her website or I think Garage Gear. What is that website with all the cottage gear manufactured? Garage Grown Gear,
I think. Okay.
But yeah, or you could just go to Bushka's Kitchen.
Cool.
And find it there.
All right. What is the dumbest thing you've ever done while you were hiking?
God. So the dumbest thing I've ever done actually happened this summer. So this summer we did a 2-week backpacking trip in Sequoia Kings Canyon. And on the last day of our trip, we were kind of anxious to get out. And so we combined 2 days into one, and we woke up at like 1 a.m. and got over this pass and took a nap. And, you know, we were on mile like 22 at this point, and I wasn't thinking, and I see this bear cub on the trail. And I remember I turn to my friend and I just keep walking. I'm like, oh, look at this bear cub. And then all of a sudden I hear Mama grunting and running down the hill at me. I have never had a close call with a bear, but that was the dumbest thing I've ever done.
Yeah, that's the one thing that can really get a bear angry, right? And you can imagine it's the same with a human, right? If a bear was between me and my child, I'd be pretty worried and pissed off too. That's interesting. You see the cub and you think how cute, and then you realize, uh-oh.
Yeah, and I think it was just the delirious. We only had, 2 miles to get back to the car. And we had been hiking, you know, for 12 hours or something. And I just wasn't thinking. I was on autopilot getting to the car. And yeah, I will never do that again.
So did Mama Bear do sort of a false charge and then back off? Or what did she do?
She made noise. She got up on her hind legs and kind of reared herself up. And I just was backing up as fast as I could.
Wow.
While talking to her. And she didn't charge, thank God.
Up on her hind legs, though. That's pretty scary.
Up on her hind legs. Yeah. Yeah. It was really scary.
So now I have to ask you, where were you in Sequoia? Because my son and I did a 1-week backpack trip in Sequoia over the summer.
Oh, yeah. So we did. Have you ever heard of the Big Seeky or Big Seki? I'm not sure how it's really pronounced.
Yeah, Sequoia Kings Canyon. I don't know what is that trip? Where is it going through?
So you start at Road's End and you go south until you meet the High Sierra Trail. Take the High Sierra Trail till it meets up with the JMT. Go north on the JMT until just after. Shoot, I always get them mixed up.
Like over by the Ray Lakes?
The one right before. And you go past Ray Lakes. Yeah, so there's two versions. You could like cut it off and go Ray Lakes, or you could go more north to whatever
pass. Is it Mather? Mather Pass, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah. Is that the one that's just south of Muir? It's whatever one is just south of Muir.
I think that's right. Yes. There's the Palisades that are right there, and there's a couple of high lakes, and then you go down the Golden Staircase, which you go up on the JMT if you're going the other direction.
Right. Yeah. We went down the Golden Staircase.
Much better to go down than up the Golden. that staircase is a butt kicker.
Oh my God. Yeah. I never need to do that staircase up ever again.
So that sounds like a fantastic trip. I did what I thought was a long backpack trip in Sequoia, but it wasn't that long. We did the High Sierra Trail and we followed that all the way up to where you would connect with the JMT, go uphill to connect with the JMT coming out of Kern Canyon. Instead of that way, we went up over, now I'm blanking on the name of the pass, but you drop into Cloud Canyon. And then you go back up Dead Man Canyon. It's like a big zigzag through Kings Canyon. And both of those canyons are they're remote and beautiful. And for listeners who haven't heard episode 6, I think it is, I did an episode with my son about that trip.
Oh, I need to listen.
Yeah, it's a fantastic trip. And, you know, you were talking earlier about taking an afternoon off in a trip and how that can be a nice thing. We took the entire afternoon off at Kern Hot Springs with nobody else there. We basically spent the entire afternoon in the hot spring.
I love that.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like we did something kind of very similar because we also went through Dead Man's Canyon.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That is a beautiful, beautiful spot, I think. Yeah. Coming out of it up over Elizabeth Pass is just fantastic. One more question for you before you go. What is the most valuable thing that backpacking and hiking has taught you?
So the most valuable thing, I think, is it's great to plan, but you got to be flexible, especially on backpacking trips. You know, if you have everything planned out to the T and you're not willing to budge, you could find yourself camping at a really swampy marsh one night when there's a really great lake a mile ahead or a mile back. So even though, you know, backpacking requires tons of planning, it also requires some flexibility and you gotta go with the flow. And whether it's taking an afternoon off because you're in a torrential downpour or finding a really great lake and deciding you want to stay there for the night instead, it's taught me to be flexible.
That is a really good lesson to learn from backpacking. And I think it's absolutely true. And we were talking earlier about how pretty much every day something happens you don't expect and you kind of have to figure out, how am I going to deal with this problem? And so, yeah, that's so true. And I do feel like it teaches you how to deal with things in the rest of your life. Once you've sort of learned how to deal, if you can deal with those kinds of problems in the backcountry, things that are much easier to deal with seem like nothing. It also, it reminds me of a Mike Tyson quote of all things. He said, I don't know if you remember Mike Tyson. He was a boxer back in the day. And Mike Tyson said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face.
That's a great quote. Yeah. So true with backpacking.
Although I hope we don't ever get punched in the face backpacking.
No.
Katie Cook, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate you being here.
Oh, thank you so much. This was a really great time. It was great talking about backpacking.
Thanks again to Katie Cook for coming on the show. I hope Katie and I have inspired you to hike the Three Sisters Loop. And keep in mind that this podcast is entertainment and meant to spark your interest. If you decide to hike the trail, do your own research. Like anything else worth doing, outdoor adventure has risk. So when you go, pack your common sense. And when you get back, tell me how it went. Before we go, I want to remind you, as always, to take advantage of the 10% discount that Outdoor Herbivore at outdoorherbivore.com gives to Trails Worth Hiking listeners. Outdoor Herbivore is a great place to buy backpacking meals. They're high-quality meals. They're vegan and vegetarian, though, as I always say, you don't need to be vegan or vegetarian to love them. So I hope you'll give them a try, take a look at what they have to offer on their website. The meals have plenty of calories for a hungry hiker. They're affordable, and there are lots of good options. They are boil in the bag, so you just pour the hot boiling water into the bag and seal it, and your dinner is ready in 10 or 15 minutes. And as I've said before, Outdoor Herbivore doesn't give me anything for offering this to you. I offer this to you because they're offering a discount to Trails Worth Hiking listeners, and because I really like their backpacking meals. So I hope you'll check them out and give them a try. If you do, tell me what you think. The discount code for Outdoor Herbivore for Trails Worth Hiking listeners is TWH10P, so Trails Worth Hiking 10%. So check them out, Outdoor Herbivore at outdoorherbivore.com. Coming up on Trails Worth Hiking, we have a two-part special that I think you're really going to love. For the hike that we're going to be covering, we're going to describe a trail that travels around the eighth highest peak in the world. You guessed it, that means we're going to the Himalayas. But you knew that was coming eventually. If you want to call yourself a hiker, your resume isn't complete until you trek the Himalayas, the mountain range with the Earth's tallest mountains. But it's not just tall mountains that make this trek fantastic. You arrive in chaotic, wonderful Kathmandu, a multicultural crossroads in the capital city of Nepal. This amazing trek that we're going to be covering is lesser known and less traveled than the most famous treks in Nepal, like Annapurna and Everest Base Camp, but it's just as fantastic and maybe even more so. And it includes a side trip up the mystical Sum Valley, almost to the border with Tibet. When all is said and done, this trip travels about 200 kilometers through some of the most beautiful mountains on Earth, through villages only accessible by trail. It passes monasteries and farms. You stay in Spartan guest houses that serve homemade Nepalese food, often cooked over a wood-burning stove. On the next episode of Trails Worth Hiking, we travel the Manaslu Circuit and visit the Sum Valley in the Himalayas in Nepal. But as I said, this is going to be a two-part series of episodes. And before we talk about the trail itself, we're going to take a step back and talk with Rajan Simkada of Earthbound Expeditions, a trekking company from Nepal, about trekking in Nepal in general, so that we all are oriented and have a good understanding of what that entails before we talk about the Manaslu and Sum Valley trek. So I hope you'll join me next time to listen to a great conversation with Rajan Simkada of Earthbound Expeditions. And then shortly after that, we'll have an episode covering Manaslu and Sum Valley. That's next time on Trails Worth Hiking. If you have any questions or feedback on this episode, ideas for future episodes, including if you want to be a guest and talk about a trail you've hiked, reach out to me at trailsworthhiking@gmail.com. So start planning your next hike. And before you know it, you'll be on the trail. Thanks for listening.